And we're back with Unusual Sources here on CFMU 93.3 FM. And we should have with us on the line Zafar Bengash. Zafar, of course, is one of the regular guests on our program. He's a leader associated with organizations like Crescent International, Muslim Media. He's a journalist, a respected Islamic scholar, and many other things, and someone who's very knowledgeable about Afghanistan and Pakistan as well. So let's see if we've got Zafar. Zafar, are you on the line with us today?
Yes, I am. Hello, Brendan.
Oh, hi. How are you today?
Thank you. I'm great.
Oh, great, great. Okay, well, it's good to have the phones working so well today.
Yes.
Well, obviously, there's a lot to talk about right now, and people are very curious. I mean, the Mumbai, the bombings have been all over the news. We're getting the U.S. reaction to this, and we're seeing things on CNN, but I'm wondering, from your sources and your perspective, what could you tell us about the reaction to the bombings in Pakistan?
Well, the reaction in Pakistan, or the reaction for you know the bombings taking place in Pakistan as well.
Oh, that's a good question. I was just referring to the reaction inside Pakistan.
Okay, well, there has been actually two levels of reactions over there. The first is the government reaction, and that came immediately after the November 26th attacks started in Mumbai, and the government of Pakistan at the official level, the foreign minister, the prime minister, they condemned these attacks and sent messages to the Indian government that Pakistan would cooperate at whatever level to investigate this matter fully. To make sure that those people who are responsible for them are brought to justice. The other reaction, of course, has been at the public level, and I think by and large the public in Pakistan has also been very upset by these attacks. Now, the whole scenario very soon turned ugly because the Indians started to make allegations against Pakistan directly to suggest that these people, number one, that they had come from Pakistan, number two, that Pakistan's intelligence agency was involved in training these people, and that number three, this is something that the Pakistani government is pursuing against India. Now, when these kinds of allegations started to surface from India, then the reaction in Pakistan turned from one of sympathy to anger. Now, what we have found so far is, and this is something that the Americans, as well as a number of Indian commentators, have confirmed, that the Indian intelligence agencies were notified by the CIA station chief in Delhi more than a month ago, as well as more than a week prior to the Mumbai attacks, telling them that there are going to be attacks occurring. This was, of course, based on the communications intercepts made by the CIA, that these attacks would occur from the sea. And they also mentioned that the Taj Mahal Hotel in particular would be targeted. Now, what is curious in this whole episode is that while the Indian Navy was put on full alert as a consequence of this information being communicated to the Indian intelligence agency, that somehow we are told that these people were able to elude the Indian Navy and still come ashore. And number two, that they were able to carry out their attacks on these various targets. Altogether, 10 targets have been mentioned by the Indian government. And they said that there were 10 individuals who were involved in these attacks. So obviously, all 10 targets were not hit simultaneously, but in the process, on the first day, as we listened to the news or watched it on CNN or other networks, we discovered that the Indians said, on the first day, in fact, they said that they had killed about 8 or 9 of them and captured another 8 or 9 of them. That's what the first day's news. Then they started to backtrack afterwards. But the story that remained consistent was that about either two or maximum of five individuals had entered the Taj Mahal Hotel, and that these individuals had taken the patrons at the hotel hostage. And this siege lasted for 3 days. Now, there are certain very serious issues that I personally have when I analyze this whole situation. Number one, the Taj Mahal Hotel has about 1,000 rooms. Now, if we were to consider, let's say, each floor has 200 rooms, then we would have 50 floors of the hotel, or if not, 50 floors, if let's say it's spread out much more widely, even if you say that each floor has, more rooms than that, the fact is that five individuals, if we take the maximum number, could not possibly have controlled 20 floors of the hotel simultaneously, number one. Secondly, five individuals, according to India's own admission, were able to keep at bay more than 200 Indian commandos and hundreds of police, Navy, and Air Force personnel. I simply cannot believe that. It is impossible, no matter how well-trained, how heavily armed these five individuals are, if they have taken hundreds of people hostage inside the hotel and that they are being attacked by Indian commandos, and one would assume that these commandos are very well-trained, they are sharpshooters, that five individuals would not be able to last for 3 days keeping hundreds of fully armed, heavily armed, very well-trained commandos at bay until these five individuals are all killed. There are a few other discrepancies in the Indian story, and then I'll come to what I think is really going on over here. The other discrepancies are that the people that were killed in the Taj Mahal Hotel particularly, autopsy reports from a hospital in Mumbai said that these people that were killed inside the hotel, most of them were tortured to death. Now, five individuals cannot be torturing people to death and simultaneously keeping track of 1,000 rooms in the hotel and fighting hundreds of commandos who have surrounded the hotel. I think this is something that we simply cannot except. It is logically not possible. One other information that again has come from Indian sources, and that is that some of these terrorists who took hostages inside the hotel, they were shot dead at close range. In fact, one Indian commentator writing about this said that he himself saw the body of one of the terrorists, and this terrorist was shot in both his eyes. And he said that we have not been told that the Indian commandos managed to get so close to these people that they would be able to shoot them in both their eyes. Number two, that these individuals, these terrorists, could not have committed suicide because obviously even a terrorist cannot shoot himself in both eyes. He can only do so in one eye and then he'd be dead. So he said that it appears that there were other people operating inside that hotel that probably were torturing people and that ultimately killed these terrorists as well. So the question is, who were these other people? And that is where I want to come to this, the crux of this story, and that is that the Indian government is not leveling either with their own people or with the international community. In India, in fact, over the last several months, there have been a number of terrorist acts perpetrated against Muslim targets, against Christians against Hindus and so on. And almost in all of these cases, the Indian government blamed the Muslims for being responsible for these terrorist acts. Now, the Mumbai anti-terrorism squad chief, a person by the name of Hemant Karkare, he, through his investigation, found out that there were a number of Indian army personnel, including in particular a serving colonel in the Indian army by the name of Srikant Prohit. This fellow, Srikant Prohit, a colonel in the Indian army, was found to have supplied the RDX explosives that were used in a number of previous terrorist acts, both against Hindus as well as against Muslims. So Hemant Karkare, the anti-terrorism squad chief, arrested a serving Indian military officer as well as a number of his colleagues, military as well as Hindu religious figures, and he was interrogating them, and this ATS chief, the anti-terrorism squad chief, Hemant Karkare, and his deputy and his chief investigator were the first persons to be killed in that terrorist attack that occurred in Bombay on November the 26th. Now, here is a person who a day earlier, Hemant Karkare, a day earlier had received a death threat against him, and he was told very specifically that either you let this Indian army colonel and these Indian priests, let them go free, or we are going to kill you. Just a day earlier, he had received that threat, and a death threat, and it has not been denied. And then on the day that this terrorist attack occurs, this fellow, the ATS chief, his deputy, and his chief investigator are the first three persons to be killed. Now, this, to my mind, would be very suspicious as to why, if there are actually terrorists that came from Pakistan, that they would be involved in killing the very people who are exposing the rot in Indian society and in the Indian military establishment. And these people, these Indian military personnel, have been traced to other terrorist acts that took place. For instance, in February of 2007, a train service that goes between India and Pakistan, it's referred to as the Samjhota Express, which means the Friendship Express. It was attacked and explosives were used, and about 68 people were killed in that train. Most of those people were Pakistani citizens who were returning to Pakistan, who had come to India to meet their relatives in India and now were returning, and 68 of them were burnt to death inside that train. Again, allegations were made against Muslims attacking that train. In fact, this group that has been named as responsible for the Mumbai attacks, Lashkar-e-Tayyiba, they were accused of involvement in that train attack. And Hemant Karkare, the anti-terrorism squad chief, was able to trace that train attack also to Colonel Prohit of the Indian Army. So this information, I think when we put together all of this information, it indicates to me that there is much more going on in India than either the Indian government is willing to admit or that they are willing to reveal. And to the credit of a number of Indian journalists, they have brought this information to surface and they have demanded that the Indian government should come clean and let the people know in India as to exactly what is going on, because there are a number of political parties in India that are backing these Indian terrorists, terrorists in their military, terrorists in their religious establishment, terrorists in their political establishment, that are behind these kinds of crimes that they are perpetrating.
Well, it certainly sounds as if the facts being given to us don't add up. Certainly,
yes,
when do they add up these days, you know?
Exactly.
If this is the case, then I guess it sounds like certain members of India's political establishment are the people who benefit from these attacks.
Exactly. You see, when I pointed out that if This information about this terrorist attack was known to the Indian government. The question arises as to why they did not take adequate precautions, number one. Secondly, why wasn't additional security provided at the Taj Mahal Hotel when it was specifically mentioned that this would be a target of a terrorist attack? And now, you know, the reason why, I mean, we could easily ask as to why is the Indian government pointing fingers at Pakistan? I personally feel that if the Indian government were to admit that there is a problem within India, then there would be a very serious political crisis for the Indian government. And I can go further, and I point out a number of Indian organizations and political parties. For instance, among the political parties, the Bharatiya Janata Party, it's a fascist party. It ruled India from 1998 to 2004. Its present leader, L.K. Advani, was the person who, in December of 1992, led a mob across India that ultimately swelled to about 200,000 people. And this mob attacked the historic Babri Mosque in Ayodhya that was demolished on December the 6th of 2002. And that mosque had been under a court order protection, and yet Advani, who's today the leader of the Bharatiya Janata Party, is a member of parliament. He was present over there, and a number of his colleagues were present over there. And despite pleas from the leaders of the Indian Muslim community to the federal government in India to provide them protection, the Indian government failed to respond. And so that historic mosque was destroyed in broad daylight in front of everybody. This was televised, and it then led to protests by Muslims in India. And those protests were then brutally suppressed, and these Hindu fascist outfits in India murdered more than 3,000 Muslims in Mumbai and in other places in India because the Muslims were protesting against the destruction of a historic mosque in India that was carried out under the direction of Mr. Advani, who is the leader of the opposition party in India today. It is also the same Bharatiya Janata Party that in May of 1998 had carried out the nuclear explosions, declaring India as a nuclear state. And it was the same Mr. Advani and his party that had threatened Mr. Hemant Karkare, the anti-terrorism squad chief, telling them to back off from investigating these Indian army officers and these Hindu priests that were implicated in these bombings in different parts of India. And there are a number of other organizations like Shiv Sena. There's another one called Abhinav Bharat, which means the New India. It's a totally fascist organization, and its stated objective is that those people who are non-Hindus in India, whether they are Muslims or Christians, they had better convert to Hinduism. Otherwise, the choice they have is either they leave the country or they would be killed. And the manner of their killing is also very brutal. They douse people with kerosene oil and then set them on fire. That is what they did to these Christians. More than 100 of them were killed in the state of Orissa in October. And this was reported by a number of Western newspapers, including the New York Times, the Christian Science Monitor. There were periodic brief reports in the Canadian media as well, but regrettably not detailed reports, and not certainly not the kinds of reports that this issue and this matter deserved.
I was just thinking, I mean, it sounds like there's a lot of backroom activities going on regarding these terrorist activities and the Mumbai bombing and so forth. And just going the news hype we're getting here, how do you think this is going to affect the Pakistan-India relations as they exist now?
Well, those relations have obviously nosedived because the Indian government has made various outlandish demands. Now, let me tell you some of the demands that the Indian government has made. For instance, they demanded that this organization called Lashkar-e-Tayyiba should be banned. Now, Lashkar-e-Tayyiba already has been banned since 2002, so it officially does not exist. Number two, there is another organization called Jamaat-o-Dawa, which means the group that invites people to Islam, that the Indian government and the American government have demanded that this organization be banned and it should be put, its assets should be frozen and it should be put on the list of terrorist organizations. It was interesting to note that yesterday there was a rally held in Pakistan by Hindus in Pakistan in support of Jamaat-ud-Dawa. And there were about 200 Hindu women in the city of Hyderabad in Sindh province of Pakistan who said that Jamaat-ud-Dawa is not a terrorist organization, and we as Hindu women can testify to the fact that this organization has been providing us relief and support not just for a few weeks, they've been doing it for more than 10 years, that we are poor people and they come and give us food and they give us grain and they give us rice and they give us money so that we as Hindus can live a slightly better existence in Pakistan. So this is something that comes from Hindu families. It was reported, incidentally, in today's Star as well, and it was reported in the Globe also. So we see that the allegations that are being made against Jamaat-ud-Dawa are, in fact, politically motivated allegations because the Indian government has not been able to provide any solid evidence. The Pakistan government has reacted to these allegations from India by saying, if you say that various individuals are involved or that these individuals are of Pakistani origin, could we please have some proof of this? Now, I want to share two other aspects with you. The Indians say that they have captured one terrorist by the name of Ajmal Amir Kasab, that he was captured alive and all the other nine of the other 10 terrorists were killed. It is now we need to note that the nine individuals that were killed, their bodies have been messed up so much, their faces have been disfigured so much that it is impossible to identify who these individuals are. And 2 days ago, a lawyer in Pakistan issued a statement. He said that Ajmal Amir Kasab is my client, and I had represented him. He was arrested in Nepal in 2005, and I had made an application on his behalf in 2005 to represent him so that I could have him extradited from Nepal back to Pakistan. And he said, how come this guy now all of a sudden appears in India and the Indians are saying that he was involved in these terrorist acts? So the evidence does not add up. Now, the third part of this ridiculous situation, the Indian government has given a list of 20 individuals to the Pakistan government demanding that these 20 individuals should be arrested and handed over to India because India wants to put them on trial. These are the ones, the people who have been backed this terrorist attack in India. Now, among the 20 people is one individual who had died 7 years ago. And so you can see that this whole thing is becoming so ridiculous, the manner in which these allegations are flying around. And naturally, it has resulted in relations between India and Pakistan nosediving. There is tremendous tension. 3 days ago, there were reports that Indian Air Force planes were, in fact, had violated Pakistani airspace. There was speculation within Pakistan that these planes were trying to attack certain bases inside Pakistan. If that had occurred, I'm quite convinced that this would have led to retaliation from Pakistan, and the chances of a war breaking out between India and Pakistan would have been very high. I believe that danger still exists, that it is quite possible that the kind of jingoism that the Indian rulers are creating, the mass hysteria that they are creating in their own country, that war may still break out between India and Pakistan. And when I think about that scenario, I think it will have frightening consequences for the whole region, because it is more than likely that Indian conventional forces would overwhelm Pakistani forces, because India has more than a million strong army. It has one of the, I think, the fourth largest air force in the world. Pakistan cannot match India's firepower or manpower in terms of armed forces. So if Pakistani forces find themselves on the defensive, and if Pakistan loses large chunks of its territory to Indian forces, then the chances are that Pakistan might retaliate with nuclear weapons. And if that were to happen, we can expect a nuclear holocaust engulfing the Indo-Pakistan subcontinent, where approximately 1.4 billion people live. And we can have maybe hundreds of millions of people dying over there in the first nuclear strikes, and then the fallout from those nuclear weapons can go on for generations, and that whole region would be just, you know, turned into a scorched earth sort of scenario. And the entire consequences are too frightening. And of course, it would have its effect on the rest of the region as well, in Afghanistan, Iran, and the Persian Gulf region, and so on. And so the consequences of a war are too horrendous to contemplate at this time. And if the Indian rulers do not back off from their policy of jingoism and trying to browbeat Pakistan into a corner, then I'm afraid we are heading for very, very serious consequences.
I think that is a grave possibility. And I'm just wondering, given that the Mumbai bombings have been exploited to maximum effect, as is customary these, do you think that India, together with the United States, are trying to put Pakistan on the defensive, given the U.S. needs in Afghanistan?
Oh, absolutely. That's what they are doing, because this has been something that Pakistani commentators have talked about openly, that the U.S. government, although it demands of Pakistan to do more in Afghanistan, and although Pakistan has about 150,000 of its troops battling its own citizens on the borders with Afghanistan, that the ultimate American objective is to destabilize Pakistan, and that would lead to its disintegration, because America cannot control the situation in Afghanistan. And whenever America cannot control a situation anywhere, it always wants to blame it on others. It is well known that America and NATO forces are facing increased resistance in Afghanistan. Only last week, the International Council on Security and Development issued a report in which they stated that the Taliban in Afghanistan now control 72% of the territory in Afghanistan. They also said that this is up from 54% last year. And the ICOS report also stated that no matter how many forces the Americans want to pour into Afghanistan, they cannot stabilize the situation. British commanders have admitted that there is no military solution to the problem in Afghanistan, that there needs to be a much greater effort at the development level. Canada, that is likely to spend $18 billion by the time the Canadian mission will be officially over in February of 2011. We don't know, this mission might get extended following Robert Gates' visit to Kandahar over the weekend. But even if we accept that the Canadian mission is going to end in February of 2011 and Canada would have spent $18 billion, I can reveal to your listeners that out of those $18 billion, $17 billion would be spent on the Canadian military. and only $1 billion out of that $18 billion will be spent on development. And even that $1 billion, from that $1 billion, only half of that money would actually go to Afghanistan, and the other half, which is $500 million, would be consumed by experts and these consultants and so on from outside. So out of $18 billion, only $500 million would go to Afghanistan, and much of that money also would end up in the pockets of corrupt Afghan officials. So there will be virtually no development in Afghanistan out of the $18 billion that Canada will spend. Now, the question we as Canadians ought to ask is, why on earth is Canadian money being spent and wasted in this futile attempt, and whether the Canadian government and the Canadian military can give us any assurances that on that day, on February 28th of 2011, as if by magic, it will be all security and peace and quiet in Afghanistan? I mean, you know, who is it that they're trying to kid, and why are they wasting Canadian lives? You know, last week, 6 Canadian soldiers were killed. Why are these lives being wasted on keeping corrupt drug lords and warlords in power in Afghanistan? The people of Afghanistan are not benefiting from this. So what is it that they want to achieve by this? Why can't they come clean with the Canadian public and tell them that this is a futile, foolish policy? It is not benefiting Canada in any way. It is not benefiting the people of Afghanistan in any way. It is creating more mayhem. It is creating more suffering over there. And if we cannot contribute to improving the lives of the Afghan people, I think we should end this foolish policy, bring Canadian soldiers home. We should not waste any more Canadian lives and Canadian money on this absolutely futile venture in a foreign land. You see, if those people don't want foreigners, why are we insisting on keeping Canadian forces over there? To my mind, this whole thing is an imperialist enterprise led by the United States, which has a very different agenda to their stated claims. The agenda is very little to do with Afghanistan. It has a lot more to do with the oil and gas reserves of Central Asia that America wants to lay its hands on, and their greedy multinational companies. And for that, Canadian lives are being wasted. For that, Canadian money is being wasted, not to mention the tens of thousands of Afghans that have been murdered and millions of Afghans that are suffering extreme poverty.
Well, it's all starting to come out, isn't it? Because if you saw, it was one of those Toronto papers, might have been the Globe and Mail or the Sunday Sun, but the father of one of the recently deceased soldiers was saying that he didn't believe it was worth it, that, you know, that it wasn't making any sense, it wasn't accomplishing things. He's not the first parent to say that, but I think that people are increasingly realizing in Canada that this is something where we have no business and that we shouldn't be involved in.
Exactly. In fact, yesterday the Toronto Star had its headline quoting this, the parent of, or the uncle of one of the dead soldiers. And I'm glad that at least, you know, this kind of information is now given adequate prominence and coverage, because in the past, what the family said, if it was negatively impacting the Canadian policy, then they would bury it somewhere at the bottom of some news section. But at long last, they're beginning to acknowledge that, and I'm glad that they have, because I think many families are speaking out, and their concerns ought to be recognized, because they are the ones who are really making the sacrifices in life and blood, and we should respect that and respect their views.
Indeed. Well, there's still a lot to talk about. I know we have to go now, but the Obama and his surge that he wants in Afghanistan and other issues are certainly things that our listeners are going to be interested in, but we'll have to catch that in a future interview with you. So, Zafar, I wanted to thank you very much today, because you gave us more information than 1,000 newspapers could have. Really appreciate that.
Thank you. It's my great pleasure. I hope that your listeners will find this of some benefit and some use, and they can reflect on it.
Absolutely, and we'll be following up on this in future weeks.
Okay.
Well, thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye. And that was Zafar Bangash. Zafar Bangash from MuslimMedia.com, from Crescent International, and other programs. There's now a television program that he's involved with as well. And, of course, you'll be able to listen to this interview online and catch other interviews by Zafar as well.